Welcome back. It's a Monday, the 13th day of May, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Call. And let's kick off our look at what's going on around the nation and the world today with war on the domestic side, particularly against the Bill of Rights, from within and without. Socialist media platforms, in what certainly looks like collusion, but it could just be that they serve the same master, you know, the prince of this world, are no longer even trying to hide their outright hatred for conservatives, the Bible, libertarians, and of course, the written law. Targets over the weekend included Michelle Malkin and Christina Leyla. The latter writes that Sharia Twitter, as she put it, locked her out of her account over a 2-year-old tweet which just happened to be critical of Islam, and they forced it to be deleted. Took them a while, though, didn't it? The tech tyrants, she writes, are wrapping up censorship of conservatives and Christians as we head into the 2020 presidential election cycle. Twitter, said Leyla, sent me a message Saturday morning letting me know I'd been locked out of my account for violating their very vague and, of course, ever-changing rules against hateful conduct over a non-violent, non-threatening tweet I posted 2 years ago when I defended President Trump against vicious attacks from Hassan Minhaj, an Indian Muslim so-called comedian who smeared the president at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in April 2017, saying during his roast that the president is the liar-in-chief and does not respect the First Amendment. Let the irony of all that sink in for a second here. Although he did admit in the same speech that, quote, only in America can a first-generation Indian-American Muslim kid get on this stage and make fun of the president, unquote. What we're now seeing is that anybody who isn't equally politically correct doesn't get to have any platform at all once they get their way. As Christina Leyla writes, well, here I am, a first-generation Armenian-American Christian, and I'm being silenced by Twitter for defending my president and my own beliefs. Let that sink in. By the way, the tweet that got her banned 2 years ago, she said Muslim Hassan Minhaj blasted our president but has no problem with 1,400 years of his religion's barbarism. Uh-oh, somebody must have called the Sharia police. And why am I thinking that if she'd referenced Christian barbarism and, say, the Crusades, there wouldn't have been any problem? I think, folks, the point here isn't that history is replete with nasty examples from all kinds of religions. It's the double standard, the hypocrisy, and the fact that speech in the public square is no longer free on the socialist media platforms. Leyla does note correctly that Twitter, to Facebook, YouTube, and Gulag are all purging conservatives and violating the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, yet Congress, with the exception of a very few, sits back silently and allows the tech companies to meddle in elections and violate that very clear section. Noting that Tucker Carlson at Fox was right when he warned President Trump that if he doesn't deal, and soon, with online censorship against conservatives, he will not be reelected in 2020 because there won't be anyone left to defend him. Concludes Christina Leyla, I am a first-generation American of Armenian descent. My Christian family suffered intense persecution in the Middle East and came to America for a better life away from Islam, and now here I am being silenced by far-left, pro-Islam tech tyrants. Conservative author, pundit, blogger, and speaker Michelle Malkin also suffered socialist media censorship over the weekend. She published a post on Facebook defending her conservative friends Laura Loomer and Gavin McInnes, saying, these are two of my friends. They've been banned from Facebook and Instagram for exercising their right to free speech, while violent jihad groups are allowed on these platforms to spread their murderous poison. I spoke out passionately about deplatforming at CPAC and have done what I can to use my voice to speak for the voiceless. Laura and Gavin are suing the radical forces, including SPLC and CARE, behind the insidious agenda to criminalize political dissent. I've donated to their causes and hope you will, too. She gives the links, and I don't know how much longer it'll be before I'm next. Well, the answer was not very, and they removed her post over the weekend. Writes the Gateway Pundit, we're now at the point where they won't allow any kind words about anybody they don't like, and thus ban. I'll follow that up with a brief story on the same topic, which basically confirms what we already knew. According to data compiled by researchers from Northwestern University, says Zero Hedge's summary, Google's left-wing bias has been exposed. Researchers from Northwestern have used an algorithm to study Google's search results and found an overwhelming left-leaning bias towards news outlets such as CNN and the New York Times, which the search giant repeatedly promoted in November 2017, according to the Daily Mail. Now, here your host will pause and say, folks, I have seen this many, many times, especially over the last month or so. Frequently, I'll see a reference in another story, or somebody will write and ask about an article referencing something, including the exact headline. From a still high-profile but not left-leaning site, I can put the exact search terms in, and guess what? The article I'm looking for often doesn't even show up on the first page. And if it's controversial, you can rest assured the WAPO New York Times and CNN headlines will be saying something exactly contrary to it, whether they admit the truth deep within the text of the article or not. Now, here's where this one gets interesting, and just maybe they're even soft-pedaling the results. Of the 6,302 articles that appeared in Google's top stories box during November of 2017, 62% were from outlets considered to be left-leaning. And, of course, guess what, folks? The ones they consider middle of the road are pretty well far left anymore anyway. Just not quite as brazenly so as those at the top of the list. CNN constituted a full 10% of the news promoted, while the New York Times and WAPO came in at 6.5% and 5.6% respectively. So-called conservative Fox News, on the other hand, accounted for just 3% of the promoted stories. And if you look at the list of the top 20, including number 4, BBC, and on down the list, USA Today, LA Times, The Guardian, Politico, ABC, CBS, NPR, NBC, CNBC, Reuters, The HuffPo, The Verge, Al Jazeera, and so on, I'd be hard-pressed to name a single source on that list that I'd consider even remotely conservative-leaning. But come to think of it, even constitutionally literate. The story goes on to note that even the number of articles produced from the left-leaning sites seems to inflate those discrepancies. Concluding, quote, if they're serious about supporting digital-first newsrooms, algorithmic news curators, including Google and others, might be more explicit in articulating the inherent design trade-offs between the relevance desirable for individuals, the diversity desirable for society, or, oh, get this, democracy, and the fair competition desirable for news organizations, unquote. One more quick story I'm going to throw on this pile. Breitbart tells us that left-wing actress and singer Bette Midler has now called on Georgia women to, quote, stop having sex with men in response to that state's passage of a heartbeat bill that bans most abortions, except for rape and incest and so forth, once a fetal heartbeat can be detected, typically at about 6 weeks of pregnancy, and it's called the Life Act. No wonder the left hates it. And the story says Midler echoed her fellow actress and political activist Alyssa Milano's call for women to abstain from sex with men via what they call a sex strike, claiming our reproductive rights are being erased. Now, admittedly, folks, and obviously, these two probably have armed bodyguards. But I do need to point out again the idiocy, it goes way beyond hypocrisy at this point, of bubble-headed gum flappers claiming my body, my choice, when they aren't willing to allow women the choice to defend that body, whether it's with a gun or against mandatory vaccinations or whatever else the left may decide they want to do to that body later on. So after all of that, it's time for a good news break via this headline from Breitbart, which says that 4 Rhode Island towns have now declared themselves to be Second Amendment sanctuaries over just the last 2 weeks. So basically, what we're seeing now is bogus sanctuary cities where the rule of law doesn't apply, and more real ones where it still does. Uprise Rhode Island reports that Burleville was the first to make the declaration, followed then by Hopkinton, West Greenwich, and Foster. Here, too, there's no shortage of irony and even ignorance. WPRI reported that West Greenwich approved its Second Amendment sanctuary status by a vote of 4-1, and the lone vote against was the council vice president, Linda Reckus Sloan, who said, get this, quote, we are a civil society. The law is what the law is. Well, if she'd put a sock in it at that point, except for her vote, she might have been on the right track. But then she went on to say, if you want to change it, you change the people over at the State House. That's how it works. Well, it may be how it works now that we don't have a constitution anymore, but when we did, people put their hand on a Bible and swore to preserve and protect and defend it against those enemies who now say, no, the law is what we say it is, not what's written in genuine print, and that's how it works. The story also notes that in bifurcated New Mexico, where left-leaning Albuquerque and Santa Fe basically dominate the state's politics at the state level, more and more sheriffs, however, in the rural counties that know better, are telling their leftist oath breakers to go pound salt, 25 of New Mexico's 33 counties have now adopted Second Amendment sanctuary status as well, saying they won't enforce the new anti-constitutional gun controls passed by the socialists in the State House. One more bit of hopefully good news before we move to the invasion from without phase. Ms. Shedlock at Mishtalk tells us that economist Judy Shelton, a Trump economic advisor and an advocate for, I hope you're sitting down, the gold standard, is rumored to be Trump's next Fed pick. She's currently U.S. Executive Director for the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development and previously worked on the Sound Money Project, which was founded to promote awareness about monetary stability and financial privacy. She even wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal back on April 21 entitled The Case for Monetary Regime Change, writing what amounts in socialist America to outright heresy, saying it's, quote, wholly legitimate and entirely prudent to question the infallibility of the Federal Reserve when it comes to calibrating the money supply to the needs of the economy. No other government institution, she wrote, has had more influence over the creation of money and credit in the lead-up to the devastating 2008 global meltdown. And the Fed's response to the meltdown may have exacerbated the damage by lowering the incentive for banks to fund private sector growth. And then she goes on to point out at least some of the implications and note that it's entirely reasonable to ask whether the Fed's so-called goals might be better assured by linking the supply of money and credit to gold or some other reference point, as opposed to relying on the judgment of a dozen or so monetary officials meeting 8 times a year to set interest rates. Writes Ms. Shedlock, Shelton is the author of a 1998 book entitled Money Meltdown, and he's ordering it to get a better idea of where she's really coming from. But regardless, he notes, I'm certain she'd have been a far better choice for Fed chair than Powell, Bernanke, Yellen, or Greenspan. And while your host is more than willing to admit that while I have seen her name a bit of late, I don't know a heck of a lot more about her. But what I do know suggests, hey, given what we're used to when it comes to Trump appointees, especially in economics, if it pans out, no doubt we could have done a whole lot worse. After all, folks, and this is to her credit, she's even willing to admit, even if she doesn't quite spell it right, that, quote, central banksters and their defenders have proven less than omniscient, unquote. Returning now to the war on rights from without, the invasion and the threats aren't just from the masses continuing to cross the porous southern border. For 27 months, as the story cited by Breitbart, there were 44 or so known illegal aliens from terrorist-sponsoring countries who were shielded from deportation by various sanctuary city laws. No, not the kind that's supported by the Constitution in this case. Reveals the IRLI, or Immigration Reform Law Institute. Those terrorist-sponsoring countries, designated as such by the Department of State, include Iran, Sudan, Syria, and North Korea. But the vast majority of them, nearly 90%, are from Iran. The IRLI investigation found that the sanctuary state of, where else, the People's Republic of California leads the country when it comes to helping illegal aliens from terrorist-sponsoring countries to evade deportation, failing to turn over 27 illegal aliens from terrorist-sponsoring countries over a 2-year period to ICE for deportation out of the U.S., preferring instead just to release them into the populace at large. Washington State likewise had 8 on the list, while Minnesota and, ironically, Iowa were next, followed by sanctuary cities in states like Arizona, Illinois, Massachusetts, Nebraska, and Texas, which also refused to help deport some illegal aliens from terror-sponsoring countries. Now here, folks, your increasingly cynical host will interject an observation based on probabilities. If I was a terrorist leader, or maybe a deep state insider, well, basically that's the same thing in some cases, wanting to establish sleeper cells in the United States, I'd probably pick very low-profile folks to immigrate quietly and stay quiet until the time came to really raise hell. In other words, I'm suggesting these numbers don't even remotely reflect the real situation, but they do reflect the real problem. Said the IRLI Executive Director Dave Wilcox in a statement, sanctuary laws are no longer a theoretical faculty lounge debate. They're causing very real threats to our safety as individuals and as a nation. Already, he said, there are innocent victims who've lost their lives as a result of sanctuary laws that defy common sense. Ironically, from people that want to disarm you to be more of a victim to them, calling that common sense instead. Anyway, back to this quote. If one of those aliens shielded from the law commits an act of mass terrorism, the politicians and activists who push for sanctuary laws will have a lot to answer for. Unquote. And here I have to disagree, because A, I don't think the American populace will ever be told if that happens, or if it's already happened even. They already don't want to tell you when they shout Allahu Akbar before doing whatever, and they certainly don't want to tell you what kinds of SSRI drugs they're on. And the FBI's main job seems to be to come and try to disappear the videos before anybody can take a look at those. So yeah, one hand does seem to keep washing the other, doesn't it? And even when the evidence does eventually come out, as we've lately seen, the really nasty high-profile traitors and terrorists tend to be shielded by the likes of the FBI and the Department of Just Us, especially if the crimes are high enough profile. So suffice it to say, your host believes there's more than ample evidence that there's an agenda at work here. So on to the summary. About 25 sanctuary cities across a multitude of states help shield illegal aliens from terror-sponsoring countries between the end of 2014 and 2017. Typically, the process entails the illegal alien being taken into state or local custody for a crime, and rather than being turned over to ICE agents for deportation, the oath-breaking public officials release the alien and the public. Furthermore, the story continues, a recent IRLI investigation showed that there are more than 10,000 illegal aliens already living in the U.S. from countries that are designated as state sponsors of terrorism. Again, more than 6,000 of those, or about 61%, are from Iran, while 20% come from Syria, 18% from Sudan, and less than 1% from North Korea. But remember, folks, even a fraction of a percent, given the millions that have invaded already, with another million this year alone, could easily amount to hundreds, if not thousands, of terror cells. And Breitbart concludes by noting that they've already chronicled the so-called diversity visa lottery, which imports more than 50,000 random foreign nationals to the country every year through a so-called random drawing, and it's already brought nearly 30,000 legal immigrants to the U.S. over the last decade from countries designated as state sponsors of terrorism. As a matter of fact, roughly 30%, or almost a third, of all visa lottery migrants who've been brought into the country in the last 5 years have come from countries that sponsor terrorism. How's that for common sense gun control? There's at least one more war today that continues to grow hotter and hotter. Call it a tariff war if you'd like, but it certainly has the potential to get a lot hotter than that. And the ripple effects are certainly making waves as well. China strikes back. Tariff hikes, dump treasuries, we will never surrender, and stocks shook, says a smattering of headlines from Just the Drudge report today. After vowing over the weekend to, quote, never surrender to external pressure, says the Zero Hedge summary, Beijing has defied President Trump's demands that it not resort to retaliatory tariffs and announced plans instead to slap their own new levies on some $60 billion of U.S. goods, starting June 1 and raising tariffs on about 2,500 different things to 25%. Among the casualties, agricultural products and Boeing. This, you may recall, after the White House raised tariffs on some $200 billion in Chinese goods to 25% from 10% on Friday, although the new rates will apply only to goods leaving Chinese ports on or after the date when the new tariffs take effect. And so far as the American press is concerned, the big issue seems to be, where else, the stock market. Where the Dow Jones Industrial Average has taken it on the chin, has broken below what's called technical support, and is now down over 600 points. Similar red ink being shed on the S&P 500 and NASDAQ, of course. Here's a quote from a high-profile trader on the street. This is starting to get serious, unquote. The yield curve has re-inverted, noted another. Stocks are crashing, says yet another piece, even as the odds for a rate cut in 2019 are now surging above 100%. A full quarter-point reduction has already been priced in, but still, that's not enough to stabilize stocks. Even the infamous J.P. Morgan is piling on with a warning that this market plunge is coming at the worst possible time for investors because neither institutional nor retail investors, they say, are currently underinvested in equities. In fact, we find the opposite appears to be true. Finally, here's one more headline. Maybe this summarizes things. Courtesy of Zero Hedge, but it comes via Bloomberg's Richard Breslow, who writes, "This reminds me of how stocks traded in late 2007. Over the weekend, I saw one of the best summaries of the political morass that we've seen in quite a while. This comes from Dmitry Orlov via the Club Orlov blog, and thanks to Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge. They titled it, "The World to America, You're Fired." And as Orlov begins, some ironies are just too precious to pass by. The 2016 U.S. presidential elections gave us Donald Trump, a reality TV star whose famous tagline from his show The Apprentice was, "You're Fired." Focus on this tagline, he writes. It is all that is important to this story. Although some sufferers of Trump derangement syndrome might disagree, this is because they're laboring under certain misapprehensions that the U.S. is a democracy, or that it even matters who's president. It isn't, and it doesn't. By this point, the choice of president matters about as much as the choice of conductor for the band that plays aboard a ship as it vanishes beneath the waves. I've made these points continuously, he notes, since before Trump got into office, and whether or not you think that Trump was actually elected, he did get in somehow, and there are reasons to believe that this had something to do with this wonderfully refreshing "You're Fired" tagline. It's a fair guess that what motivated a whole lot of people to vote for him was their ardent wish that somebody would come along and do that, fire all of the miscreants that infest the Washington, D.C. swamp and surrounding areas. Alas, that he couldn't do. Figurehead leaders are never granted the authority to dismantle the political establishments that install them. But that's not to say it can't be done at all. What happened instead, continues Orloff, was that the political establishment spent 2 years thrashing about in search of a reason to say, "You are fired" to Trump. But they've been unable to find one, or even make one up, your host notes, and so Trump remains in office, although to say that he remains in power would be to invite sardonic laughter from anyone who knows what real political power smells like or even looks like. Trump, he says, is but a prisoner in the White House, and ironically, the quest for his impeachment has been fruitless as far as firing him, but perhaps more fruitful when it comes to enhancing his ability to not only fire lots of establishment figures, but perhaps even send them to jail with the help of the Department of Justice. And here I have to say, yeah, this is optimistic, I know, so don't hold your breath, but it is at least an interesting take. And just wait, folks, we're coming to the punchline. And it's his character trait, says Dmitry Orlov, of extreme rancor, spitefulness, and vindictiveness that should be most conducive towards that end, making for a fun spectacle. And it's that twist that your host found so refreshing. Orlov goes on to say that his numerous enemies and detractors may yet look back wistfully on the halcyon days when they could lambast him with impunity. All right, well, here Dmitry Orlov regales us with a brief recap of what most of the regular listeners here already know. The fact that the quest to stop Trump at any cost started well before the election, with the Obama regime and the Clintons collaborating on misusing federal resources to dig up something, anything on Trump, specifically, though, evidence of Russia collusion, and they, couldn't find anything, couldn't even make it up, and couldn't get away with it. And as we've heard, if there's no crime, there's no proceeding, nothing to obstruct, influence, or to impede. There ensued, he continues, a sort of bureaucratic dance macabre. And it eventually all played out as follows. After the midterms, Trump said, "You're fired," to Jeff Sessions, and William Barr was confirmed. Barr then said, "You're fired," to both Rosenstein and Robert Mueller for being unpardonably dense. And he also made it clear he plans to leave no stone unturned in investigating this fantastic instance of misuse of official resources and prosecutorial misconduct. That ought to be fun to watch. But there are things to pay attention to that are even more important. Because there's a whole lot going on right now, and the entire planet is rapidly reconfiguring itself, he writes, to the end that Western European nations are attempting to reclaim the sovereignty they ceded to the United States and the European Union, while Eurasia is coming together to form a massive economic and security conglomerate centered on China and Russia. While the world's central banks do their best to get rid of the U.S. dollar reserves they've been holding and buy gold instead, which, as of this April, they're now allowed to consider a Tier 1 risk-free financial asset. And to make the rest of this long story short, wouldn't it be funny if a lot of the gold supposedly stored in the U.S. turned out to be missing? Oh, and since the ploy to seize control of Venezuelan oil fields has backfired spectacularly and embarrassingly, defending the U.S. dollar against what's ahead may be a tall order. Still, concludes Orlov, a whole lot of folks remain in denial, so the polite thing to do is to bid them adieu, because most won't figure it out until it's way too late. So use the time we have, he says, because time is running out for the U.S., and once it has run out, what we'll hear, in a supreme twist of irony, is the whole world telling the United States, "You're fired." And on that note, thanks for being with us, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.